Accession number 28698, Reel 13.
You've got all these young soldiers. You've got all these young soldiers, 60%, who've never been to Northern Ireland. What was the response, in general terms, of those lads thinking, oh my God, I've got to go over there?
Well, what we did, we all went off to Senlager. You did the internal security, you did up-to-date riot control. We were brought up-to-date on the weapons we were against us that the IRA had, the patrolling techniques that were proven to be successful, bomb identification, IED identification, booby trap identification. So we learned all that, how to tackle situations, how not to get into cul-de-sacs that you couldn't get out of. So all the training that every regiment had been going through for several years was all taught to us, and we reenacted that. And when the Northern Ireland Training Advisory Team gave us the tick in the box to say every man in Tulare was fit for role, that's when they say, oh, no matter what's thrown at us in Ireland, we're up to the job.
And this was a two-year tour, you said?
No, not this one. This was one of our last four-month tours. So July actually saw us back in Belfast. Again, in different areas of Belfast, depending which company you were in. I was still in support company, but I had now been promoted, and I was the INT sergeant.
That's intelligence, isn't it?
Intelligence sergeant, and I'd gone into Brown Square. But as for the battalion, within 1 hour of actually being back in Belfast, Corporal Eddie Waits, a very good friend of mine from B Company, he'd been shot at by a sniper, and luckily didn't actually hit him. But the situation had gone back to 72 and 73. In fact, the riots that we had once we got into the tour were the worst since 1973. Well, like I said, I'd gone into Brown Square, which was more or less the interface with the Shankill Road, which was Protestant strongly held, and the Unity Flats, which was Catholic held, which leads you onto the Falls Road and then into the city of Belfast. Everybody was up in arms again on the streets. In fact, straight a couple of weeks after we get into the tour, in fact 2 days in August, I think it was the 7th to the 9th, 38 rounds had been fired at Tualai in a riot situation that was live ammunition at us, and the battalion had retaliated during the riots with 565 baton rounds fired back into crowds.
What were these baton rounds like?
Well, they were still then the rubber bullets, long black solid rubber, again to be aimed at the ground to bounce up, to take your legs out so people could capture you if need be. But the riots were so large and so strong, and we had four companies covering an area which had previously been covered by 8 and 10 companies of Belfast. So we're trying our best, and at one stage we were up-strengthed by other battalions and had 7 companies attached to our battalion to restore law and order, especially in the Turf Lodge, the White Rock, the Ballymurphy, and that part of the area.
Had the tactics changed at all? I know you're talking about riots, but were they exactly in the same way as they rioted before, at least dealt with in the same way?
What was happening, the riots weren't so much in your face, army against orders. We would come round and the streets would be blocked with barricades and the local population, children throwing bricks and bottles and stones. But we're now getting into the league where the riot or the crowds would open up, the gunmen would shoot through, and then the rioters would close up again so we couldn't shoot back into them. And we had several incidents, like our platoon sergeant at the time, who stuck his head out to see what was going on and was badly gashed with bricks and everything and had to be casuvacked out.
Were you in vehicles during this kind of...
No, we were never in vehicles, although you always had the one-ton Humber pigs at the back and Saracens, in case you had to crash through the crowds to get injured people out. But the IRA had upped their bombing campaign. IEDs, improvised explosive devices, booby-trapped cars, bombs in buildings. And in one particular stage, on one of our companies, again, it was a support company who were in the Moyard again, the IRA somehow knew that we'd taken the listening devices out of the drains under the camp for repair. So somehow it was a bit of an inside job, this. And they measured a lump of string on a board to float through the drains underneath the camp. And luckily, being Irish, they got the measurement wrong. Because the next time they did it, they put the explosives on the piece of wood to float down. When they thought it was under the middle of the camp and they remotely controlled, blew it, it was actually outside the camp gates, under the Springfield Road. The timing was right, because a patrol of buglers and anti-tank guys were running out the gate, and the road erupted, and some of the lads were chucked about 14 feet in the air. Some badly injured about the legs and the lower parts of the body. Nobody killed. But had that bomb floated a few feet further, a few yards further, it would have been under the yard where all the troops were at the loading bay, ready to run out. They would have caught three or four patrols, 24 men, and they would have hit them all. Luckily, they only hit the first four men running out the gate and badly injured some of them. So the IRA had upped their bombing. So Tuolai increased our searching techniques and houses and outer buildings and stuff like that. And we found several weapons and explosives in everywhere we searched. It means the IRA were really stockpiling weapons in the hardened areas. Because I was INT at the time, I was concentrating, believe it or not, on the Protestant INT. I was looking at the UVF and the UDA and people like that. And I was physically patrolling the Shankill Road and gathering information on the leaders and the gangs of the Protestant groups.
Where was the information coming from?
Well, again, intelligence-led, IUC, tip-offs and phone calls, and, of course, the touts that were always there. That was informers paid by the police, paid by the army, to inform on other people. Again, we didn't antagonise the Protestant community that much, but if they were committing crimes and criminal events, we followed it through. That's what we were there for, to uphold the law. The battalion started to reorganise slightly in that part of Belfast and to concentrate on the hardened IRA strongholds in the Ballymurphy and the Lower Falls. So the Protestant INT part and all our records were sent to a building in 219 Springfield Road, it was called, which was a secure building with a wriggly tin round it again. And I was the Protestant IO by then, looking at all their records, and I was guarded by the recce platoon of the battalion. So we had a listening, looking watch on the Protestant estates without over-emphasising what we were doing, and continuing to compile all the information we could on a daily basis into the records. And so it was me protected by the recce. So I would go out on patrols with them anyway and gather all the information we could.
So you brought that information back, I presume, and that coming in from other sources?
Yeah.
And what did you do with it? It's there. What do you do with it?
Collate it all to make sense, confirm it in parts, or if we were told that, if we went out, and were them people frequenting that pub? Were these people talking to each other? Were they meeting in certain buildings and pubs and youth clubs if necessary? And when you could confirm it, it was all put on paper, and it would go to the battalion INT, who would put it up to brigade INT, and then it would be actioned by the sources who needed to action it.
And could you see things developing amongst the Protestant paramilitaries?
Absolutely, every day. Absolutely. You'd see certain people, I mean, they were frightening, more frightening than the IRA. In fact, we got called out onto one situation. The recce found a body in a street, believe it or not, called Downing Street. And it turned out to be an ex-para who decided to sell his services to the UDA, he thought, but he'd been directed by a young lady to the UVF pub on the Shankill Road. They saw he was wearing army socks and an army watch, so took it that he was an army spy. Took him into an upper room of this pub and tortured him to death. He was found with cigarette burns all over his body and his face and his arms and his legs. And then they took him out in the middle of the night, and he was wearing a blue puffer jacket, you know, these quilted jackets. They put an orange rope around his neck, tightened the bumper of a car, dragged him up the street, having shot him several times in the top of the head as well. When we found him, we thought he had no head on because his puffer jacket had come over his shoulders and up to his head. And when we looked in the top, you could just see this pulp and blood coming out. When we pulled his coat down, I thought I recognised him as being a member of the UDR. And actually went to his house to tell his widow that the husband had been killed, only for the husband to answer the door. It turned out, say, when we took his army watch off and read the number on the back and we put it through army quartermastering departments, it came back that it had been stolen by a member of Tupara. And this turned out to be that soldier who had left the army, or been kicked out of the army, for having explosives in his locker. So he came up with his comeuppance at the hands of the UVF. And there was several other incidents like that of bodies. In fact, we found more bodies in the Protestant estates than the rest of the companies were finding in the Catholic estates, because the Protestants had their own punishment people as well. But what they were doing, they were going to a Catholic estates on dark nights or misty nights, and they would kidnap Catholics, and they would say, "You're Catholic?" And they would say, "Yeah." And they would kidnap them, and they would take them away, and they'd actually beat them to death or kill them to death. There was one particular bloke who used to do it with a hammer. He used to beat the heads in with a hammer. And
savagery, isn't it?
Oh, they were. I say, much more frightening than the IRA. The IRA would bomb you, shoot you, and one thing or another, but these people would torture you to death. And they had all kinds of horrible things. And they had back rooms in pubs called romper rooms. And if they caught anybody that they needed to torture, in fact, they had a system of tying people on a mattress, stabbing you with knives with a T-bar across that would only let the knife blade go in about half an inch. So after you'd been stabbed 100-odd times, you still weren't dead, but you'd be slowly bleeding to death. Then they'd just pour petrol on you, you and the mattress, set fire to it, and all we would find would be a charred body on the springs left of the mattress. They were wicked people. Absolutely wicked.
Were you able to catch any of them?
Oh, yes.
Deal with them?
Yeah. Again, we used to do the same as what we used to do with the IRA. You'd catch them at 4 o'clock in the morning when they were still drunk or whatever. And we used to take them into intelligence cells, or certain parts of intelligence cells, with blackout curtains. And we'd have photographs on the walls of people with bullet holes in their heads or people who had been blown up, so it was just loads of jelly and guts. And you know, it's like when you're a sour belly first thing in the morning, and we turn the lights on, and that's the first thing they would see, all these dead bodies, or photographs of dead bodies. So they weren't in there, they were in a bit of a delicate state, so it was easy to talk to these people then and get some answers. But yeah, we used to arrest them, same as we did arrest anybody else who was causing criminal offences.
Did you get involved in any interrogation yourself of these people?
Just at a low level, because I was only company int. Later in life I did. I went away and did the courses. But
were there any claims that there was beatings in these interrogations?
No.
Anything of that nature?
Well, there was never any beatings. There were.
No, I realise, but I mean, obviously
we just caught them all not on the weak spots. But no.
It was beating kind of psychological.
It was psychological. There was no physical beatings. Not that I know, or not that I witnessed, put it that way. In the October alone, we had 21 shootings against us, and even the CO was shot at in his Land Rover, and the bullet, well, it went between him and the driver and lodged in the battery box under his seat, because the batteries in FFRs go under the seat. And the CO knew he'd been shot at, but it wasn't until he got back to Springfield Road police station that he realised the bullets had been that close to the cheeks of his bum.
How could you deal with booby traps? What was the system? Or was there a system?
You were taught to look out for the signs, aerials, wires, and stuff like that. In fact, one incident that I can tell you about, again, it was one of my old corporals, young Wilfie Marshall, used to be one of my soldiers in the early 73s. He caught some people on a motorbike and opened the panniers of the motorbike and found what he knew would be a bomb. But you've always got to get AITOR, the ammunition technical officer, to identify it. So he was doing it over a telephone, over the radio. And AITOR said, well, what's it look like? He says, well, it weighs about 2 pounds and it's wrapped in black masking tape and it's got a brown and black wire on and it's got a detonator on one end. And the AITOR said, how close are you to that bomb to describe it in that much detail? And he says, I've got it in my hand. After that, we got taught not to touch bombs, but it didn't go off.
Were they timed or fired by what, electrically charged? Or what?
Some of them were electric deaths, some of them remote controlled. But these were Protestant bombs on the way to the Protestant Highfields UDA Club, and it was Protestants that were carrying them.
And so, it must be, and it probably explains it, it must be extremely difficult for anyone travelling by in an army vehicle to see a bomb. I mean, you're travelling at some speed, you can't. Well, it's pretty good eyesight to see wires and that kind of thing.
No, it's telltale signs again. If all of a sudden a busy street is all of a sudden empty, and there's a car parked where there's not normally a car parked, and things like that, you realise you aren't going to drive past there. There's a reason why there's nobody on the streets, because they do get told to clear the streets, and that's one of the first telltale signs. You're going through that street every single day, it's busy, 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 and then all of a sudden, well, there's nobody on the streets. Why? What's out of place? Seen out of place. Then you just fetch the ammunition technical experts in, and AITOR will send his little robots in and do the business.
That's okay in that sense, but I suppose if you get IRA bombing civilians, the Protestant civilians, as this happened, that would be a different matter, because those streets would be filled.
Well, yes, when they blow the fish shop up and stuff like that on the Shankill Road, yeah. But that's very brave IRA men working in the heart of a Protestant street or village or whatever and doing what they're doing. But that's few and far between. Most of them are in town centres.
They were aimed for yourselves?
Aimed at knowing the soldiers would walk by there at some time of the day. It's just a case of some man sitting up in a bedroom window with a remote control switch, waiting for that patrol to go by. I mean, that's what we were worried about anyway.
The concentration must have been absolutely enormous for the lads out on the streets.
Your mind never switches off. You are looking, but you're trained to do it. You're trained to recognise car number plates, car designs, car colours, people associated with cars and colours and numbers and locations and addresses. So your mind is really, really full, but you are really well trained, and it comes automatic. For as long as you don't switch off, you'll come in at one end and you will go out the other end all right. But because the IRA were up in there bombing and shootings incidents again back to the 1972s and 3 days, we again upped our search and everything, and even in October we found another 7 pistols, 300 rounds of ammunition, 30 pounds of explosives, several armour lights, and we realised these weapons were getting moved around the city and in and out of the estates by whom? And then it was worked out by intelligence sources and observation that it was the 200 black taxis owned by the IRA, the famous black taxis. So we start searching all black taxis, and that's where we're finding all these arms and ammunition and explosives and everything else. So by the end of that tour, or near the end of that tour, we'd actually captured, caught and jailed through conviction 47 IRA terrorists. 130 of the one arrests had been made, and they were ongoing as we were leaving for that particular tour, associated with bombs, shootings and blasts. And as we were handing over to Para in the December, we'd cleaned the patch up a great deal through concentrating on intelligence-led searching and techniques and black taxis and people that we knew. Again, I was finishing off on the prod side alive, and I was handing over to the Highlanders, I think it was, when the rest of the battalion was handing over to the Paras.
Did the black taxi drivers know that they were carrying weapons? Were they part of the scheme?
Oh, absolutely. Because, like, soldiers going around every section having a radio talking to each other, because the taxis have a radio and they're talking to each other. So they knew where soldiers were, where soldiers weren't. So they could tell each other where not to go, where to go, what to do. That street's safe. Get up the street now with your weapons in the back of your car. Oh, it was an intricate way of moving arms about. Absolutely.
After a spell, in this case for 4 months, you must have been pretty well exhausted, you know, mentally and physically after such a spell.
Yeah, mentally and physically is absolutely correct. You come back, you've lost a stone in weight, or you've lost lots of weight. You're drawn. Your mind is mentally drained from concentration all the time.
It must take a while to settle down to your family if you went on leave or wherever.
Yes, it did. I didn't think it used to bother me, but even on the 73 tour, my wife said, you were wild for months later, and I hadn't realised it, and then when I look back, yes, I can see that. You can never lie still in bed for more than a couple of hours. I still think I suffer from that now, actually, because you were so used to only having 2 hours sleep in 24 and 4 hours sleep off, four on and one off, and you get in such a routine. I still don't sleep properly now. Of course, cars backfiring will make you jump. Large crowds, when you don't know who's in the middle of that crowd, makes you nervous. I suppose there's parts of me now will never be the same again. And of course, the sights and the sounds that you see as well. So
I've seen some dreadful sights.
Well, you do, but you've got to be the right place at the right time, or more correctly, the wrong place at the wrong time to actually see the worst of the sights. Most soldiers won't see anything. Even if they're part of it, they won't see it, because they'll do their bit and be taken away from it.
For actually life locked in these camps, or whatever they call them, these strong points, I know you could move around within them, within reason. That it must have been pretty strict and very narrow sense.
Well, yes, it is. I mean, that's why sometimes it was a relief to be on patrol. At least you were there with the blue sky above you. Because remember, in all these buildings, you've got no windows, you've got no nothing else. Everything's armoured.
What about food? We're well fed. Or what food are you getting?
Food was not a problem. It's all fresh. And again, it would be delivered at night, or delivered in armoured cars, or brought in by other patrols. And food, that part was normal. It was just sleep patterns and patrolling techniques that were abnormal.
Did that cause any kind of shortness of temper between the soldiers under this pressure?
A lot of black humour. Even when somebody got killed, there was always the army black humour that got everybody through. And again, tours were still only 4 months tours at this particular stage of the game as well. So you could sustain 4 months with a 4 day break in the middle or somewhere, depending which part of the stagger you were on.
Was there anything else on this particular tour?
No. 76 finished as busy it was when we started. Bombs and bullets every day, and we didn't lose any more men. It was a successful tour, but it had gone back to the early 70s. Every day there was incidents. Yeah.